The study continues in Revelation 17 on the completed notes that we have now sent out. We had left off our scriptural consideration of the expression, the bottomless pit. Now, if you print out or open that PDF document, either way, and if you go to page, it's actually on page 6, but I think we're going to pick up on page 5 for a moment, just because we want the context for the bottomless pit. And so, let's see here. Sister Cheryl, can you read Revelation 17 verses 7 and 8, please?
And the angel said unto me, wherefore dost thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman, and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast that thou sawest was, and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is.
Any opening comments here, Sister Cheryl?
No, I'll leave it. No, no, thank you.
Okay. All righty. This expression in 7 and 8 is, once again, we're back to the time frame of the sixth head. We're back to the time frame where we have Brother Russell's writings, the Harvest Message, explaining to us, the John class, what had historically happened during the Dark Ages. During the time of papacy's reign, we had been back in time, verses 3 through 6. We had been carried in the spirit back to see this terrible history of the papacy, when she was supported by the Roman Empire beast of a church and state government back in that fourth head period. But now we've come back to the time frame of the chapter in the sixth head period, the Victor Emmanuel, the second time period, the time period of the Harvest Message. And so the Harvest Message has been explaining to us about the astonishment that we have when we come to learn the atrocities of and blasphemies of the papacy. And then it goes on in verse 7 that the Harvest Message explains the mystery of the woman and the beast that had carried her. And it, of course, as the 7 heads and 10 horns, as we've been talking about, again, an identifier of the Roman Empire. In verse 8, the beast that thou saw. Now, we're just going to say, the beast which thou saw, we saw it when we went back in history to the fourth head period of the so-called Holy Roman Empire. We went back and we saw that beast when it was empowered as a church and state government. And, from approximately 800 AD, with Charlemagne being crowned by the Pope, down to 1799, that thousand-year counterfeit millennium when Napoleon had, the year earlier, imprisoned the Pope and he died in prison in 1799 at the time of the end. So we were looking back at that fourth head period, and that's where we saw the beast that was. But then we're told the beast is not, because the beast, the church state form of government, is not in existence during the sixth head period. The church state form of government over the Roman Empire, as it were, ceased when Napoleon had imprisoned the Pope, and the Pope died in prison, 1799. So Napoleon and his descendants are the fifth head. And our Victor Emmanuel II, his descendants, are the sixth head. But it tells us that the beast that thou sawest was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. That means that this beast, this fourth head church state form of government, with the papacy having great influence, is going to arise again, as it were. It will become another head again. It's a repeat head. And we think it's the eighth head. But it's going to be for a short time. And then the church state form of government will be destroyed, go into destruction. And of course, the papacy and Protestantism will go into destruction at that time too. So that was our framework. And we were just making a connection in Revelation 17 to verse 11. And the beast that was a church state union, fourth head, and is not, it's not during this sixth head time frame of Victor Emmanuel where we're reading, even he is the eighth. That's why we're saying that it's a repeat head, and is of the seven, and goes into destruction. So that's part of what's so mysterious, is that there could be a short period of time where a church state form of government would have a repeat performance. But that's why this beast that supported the woman, this church state form of government, that's why it's in a bottomless pit, is because it's going to be loosed, as it were, it's going to come out of that bottomless pit condition for a brief time before it's utterly destroyed. So we're going to look at the bottomless pit some more, but let me just ask, are there any comments on this so far? Okay. So then we looked at, now I'm on page 6, we looked at the first example in Revelation 9, 1, 2, and 11, back during the fifth trumpet period with John Wycliffe, and that it was the Bible and biblical truths that were in the bottomless pit. Papacy had restrained the Bible and Bible truths, but John Wycliffe had the key to the bottomless pit, and he, in translating the Bible into English from the Latin, made the Bible accessible. It was no longer in a prison house, as it were. It was no longer restrained. It was now free to the people and made open. And all the truths that are found in the scriptures, when you can read them in your own language, were now also came out of that bottomless pit. And to the papacy, it was horrible. But to those who were embracing the truth and John Wycliffe's teachings, they were wonderful and refreshing. So the Bible and Bible truth came out of the bottomless pit that papacy had put it in. It had showing that the Bible had been restrained, but not destroyed, only to have the Lord use John Wycliffe to release it out of the bottomless pit condition. Questions on that? Now, we went over it last week, and I don't mind looking at it again, but okay. Then the second example was in Revelation 11:7. This was a bit more challenging because there's a greater variety of opinion on this, but that's okay. We adopted Brother Russell's in Revelation 11, the 1260 days. We had adopted Brother Russell's suggestion from the first volume, as well as from several reprints, that there was a secondary 1260 years interpretation. For those who aren't familiar with that, you might look at the first volume, page II, and also reprint 5742 and 5752. And that was that there was a 1260 year period where the Bible was set aside and was replaced by church councils and creeds. And it's interesting in that the two witnesses, the Old and New Testament, clothed in sackcloth, Revelation 11, verse 3, the sackcloth with the dead languages of Latin, that the Romish church had the monks translate the Bible into. However, in our verse 7, 11:7, and when they shall have finished their testimony, that would be the Old and New Testament that had been clothed in Latin sackcloth. The beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and kill them. And their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom in Egypt, where our Lord was crucified. And they, the people and kindreds and tongues and nations, shall see their dead bodies 3.5 days. And will not suffer their dead bodies to be put in graves. So, when we studied through this 11th chapter, we had suggested that the emphasis of the scripture is not on the beginning of this 1260 year period, but rather the ending of it. Because it is after they gave their testimony, clothed in sackcloth. It's at the end of a 1260-year period that then their bodies are in the streets 3.5 days, the Old and New Testament. And here it was suggested that we have an exact period of 3.5 years from November 23rd, 1526 to May 24th, 1530. The point being is that the starting and ending date is when the bishops in England purchased Bibles that were translated in English to publicly burn them, which they did. And there were many different burnings. But then the last public burning of Bibles that the bishops purchased was in that May 24th, 1530. So it seems to denote this 3.5 year period in which the dead bodies of the Old and New Testament, as it were humiliated by being burned publicly. That was the key. But then the bodies arose. In other words, then the Bible became even more readily accessible in more languages of the people. It couldn't be suppressed. And it was the time of the Great Reformation. And when we studied this, we went over, there were nearly 70 different translations of the Bible into common languages in the 1500s. So it was extremely remarkable that even the Catholic Church, even though they favored the Latin Bible by Jerome, they even put one in the common language of the people. We won't go back over all that, but that's from our Revelation 11 study. We did spend quite a bit of time going through that. But to focus in on verse 7, 11:7, and when they, the Old and New Testament, have finished their testimony, that is, clothed in sackcloth of the dead language of Latin, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them. You could read this as if it's saying the beast ascends out of the bottomless pit at that point. But rather, we think that's not what it's saying. It's like a parenthetical thought. It's telling us that the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them. So it's telling us, we think, that the church state form of government that was then existence in the 1500s and persecuted the Old and New Testament, as we just described, that's the same beast that's going to come out of the bottomless, first is going to go into the bottomless pit, and then is going to come out of the bottomless pit in the future. So at the time of this writing in Revelation 11, the beast wasn't in the bottomless pit yet. It was going to go into the bottomless pit when Napoleon would come on the scene in 1799. It would be then that it would go into the bottomless pit because the fifth head, Napoleon, would come into existence, followed by the sixth head, Victor Emmanuel. But it's telling us that this is this same beast. But you notice that it's telling us when they shall have finished their testimony, then parentheses, as it were, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and kill them. But turn to Revelation 17. In verse 11, and the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into destruction. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, which received no kingdom, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. That's this beast that comes out of the bottomless pit. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. This church state form of government. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. So, brethren, it's going to stop there because I want to emphasize that whenever the beast, this church state form of government, is in power, in existence, it's making war against either God's holy word or against the Lamb of God and the saints with him. This is what the church state form of government does. It makes war against God's holy word and against God's holy people. Always has, and whenever it's in power, it always will. So that's the connecting link, we think, between this bottomless pit expression in Revelation 11 and a bottomless pit expression here in Revelation 17. Okay, does that elicit any comments? Ruth.
So, in Revelation 11 that we were reading, if the beast came out of the bottomless pit, back then, there'd be no beast around for 17, because as soon as it comes out of the bottomless pit, it goes into perdition. It hangs around for a very short time and goes into perdition. So it really couldn't be back then happening because of where it is on the stream of time.
Yes, that's an excellent point. Because in Revelation 17, the beast that comes out of the bottomless pit, we are told it only has power for 1 hour, that it's destroyed because it makes war with the Lamb, never to be again. So if this same beast back in Revelation 11 came out of the bottomless pit either back in the 1500s, like we're suggesting, that, well, it hadn't gone into the vault, but the time frame would have been the 1500s. Or if the bottomless beast had come out of the pit in 1799, either way, it wouldn't fit the overall time frame. So this has to be a parenthetical thought in Revelation 11:7. No matter which view you like, it still has to be a parenthetical thought. The beast is not coming out of the bottomless pit in Revelation 11:7. It has not yet gone into the bottomless pit. All right. Thank you, Ruth. That's a good observation. Sister Debbie.
Just a question that came to mind. I don't know if I caught it all, but in, you went to Revelation 11 and said, in verse 9, and the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall not suffer their dead bodies put into graves. Is that like they wouldn't allow the Bible to be completely gone? You know, I mean, buried, that's it. They're completely gone, but they wouldn't allow them to be completely buried. Do I have the right thought there? I'm sorry. Over.
No, that's a good question. What we think it's showing is, the public humiliation of the Old and New Testament. After they had given their testimony in sackcloth and ashes, when they start to then be able to be read in the common language of the people, the papacy then tried to humiliate the Bible, try to humiliate the two prophets by burning them publicly and not giving them, as it were, a proper burial. You know, that's what it's saying, that they'll see the dead bodies for 3.5 years and not suffer the bodies to be put in their graves, verse 10. And they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them and make merry and send each other gifts, because these two prophets tormented them that dwelt on the earth. So it's just pointing out that this is those on the earth were those under religious restraints, and there, that was the Roman Catholics. And the Roman Catholics were rejoicing at seeing this public humiliation of the Bible, that these bishops were purchasing the Bibles and burning them publicly. And they would go to these big bonfires of the Word of God. They would go to these bonfires and they would rejoice and they would carry on as if this was a big public party. But it's the Word of God that was being destroyed. And Sister Debbie.
So when it says and they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations, that doesn't mean everybody. That just means those who were under the sway of the Catholic Church. Over.
Yes, that's what it means. It's the people who are the Roman Catholics throughout Europe and in England that were rejoicing to see the persecution of the Bible in the public language. They believed it should have just been left in Latin. Ruth.
We kind of have an expression for that now. Like if somebody has a constant axe to grind against somebody, it's like we say, lay it to rest already. Let it, just get over it. And they had this constant axe to grind against the scriptures, and so they wouldn't stop it. The only thing that stopped it was that the Spirit entered into them and they started to become popular with the average person that wasn't on the earth.
Yes. You know, I hate to bring it up because it's a terrible mental picture, but this has happened very recently, and that was on October 7th. And on October 8th and 9th, there was a video shown of the Hamas terrorists taking this poor woman that they had mutilated and they had her dead body in the back of a pickup truck, and they were driving it through Gaza. And they were rejoicing at this poor woman. They had abused her, and she was dead, and they were still abusing her. And these diabolical people were using their cell phones, and they were shooting videos of it, and it was flashed all around the world. And those the Arabs that were sympathetic and Palestinians were sympathetic, they were rejoicing over seeing her dead body humiliated. Horrible. But this is the picture the scriptures here are trying to give us, except the dead bodies is the Old and New Testament that are in the language now of the common people. And so it's that same diabolical type of thinking. And you know what? It was the Old and New Testament that had tormented the Roman Catholics. And so they were happy to see it put down in a sense. They just wanted to be told what to do when they went to church, said the mass, said their confessions, and that's all they wanted. They didn't want to be responsible for the biblical truths when they came out. That was scary to them or made them responsible. Anywho, okay. Anything else on this? All right. Sorry for that. October 7th reference. Let's take a look then at the last bottomless pit reference. It was in Revelation 20. And I'll have someone else read there for us. Sister Molly, could you read Revelation 20 and 1 through 3, please?
Okay. Revelation 20, 1 through 3. And I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss and holding in his hand a great chain. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil or Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. He threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it over him to keep him from deceiving the nations any more until it were ended. After that, he must be set free for a short time.
And then verse 7, please.
7. When the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Opening comments on that, Sister Molly?
No, thank you.
Okay. Would someone like to elaborate on these verses for us? Connect it with the bottomless pit. Brother Mark.
So here it appears that the bottomless pit is one last time that Satan, I'm not sure if they're referencing the church with it, but Satan's going to have one last attempt in this little season to tempt the world of mankind. And after the millennium, after the highway of holiness has been opened up for all of mankind, and receive the blessing and, you know, understand the truth and, you know, have this wonderful opportunity on the highway of holiness. And then, so Satan comes out of this bottomless pit one last time just to try mankind, and then he will be destroyed after that. Over.
Okay. Right. That's it. That's really it. Okay, but other comments on this, Sister Molly?
I just, yes, I'm wondering, so Satan will be locked into the bottomless pit, as well as his system, the church-state system. Is that the right idea?
Well, his systems are really, he's the god of this present evil world. So all the injustices and inequities and all the deceptions will eventually be locked up with him. They won't be allowed until after that 1,000 years is over. Then he can come forth and deceive again with whatever means he wants to use. The Lord permits it for this little season.
So the beast is not Satan, though. That is the system.
You're asking the right question. So let me say that the beast of church-state form of government is destroyed back in the 17th chapter, destroyed in the 18th and 19th chapter. So when Satan is finally bound in the bottomless pit, there will not be church-state system any longer, because that came out of the bottomless pit. That beast came out of the bottomless pit. We'll have power for 1 hour, and then it's destroyed.
Okay, thank you. It was that time frame I wasn't...
Yes, okay. Good question. And we like to think, in just a very, insufficient way, when Satan is loose in this little season in verse 8, it goes on and talks about how, like, Gog and Magog came up, showing more of a civil type of deception rather than the religious deception that the beast had been. And probably for good reason, because you're not going to get much of a religious deception by the end of 1,000 years, because everyone will have known the truth. So that would not be successful for Satan anyway. But that's just the beast is destroyed before the highway holiness is opened, so it's gone. But here again, this is interesting that the bottomless pit in verse 7, it's explained that it's like a prison. Something's being restrained, but it's not yet destroyed when it's in the bottomless pit. So if it's evil, like the beast or like Satan, when they're released from their imprisoned or bottomless pit condition, so to speak, they go into destruction. But there's something very interesting that we have to say. Remember back the first example in Revelation 9 about the Bible coming out of the bottomless pit and the biblical truths under John Wycliffe? They aren't destroyed. It's never mentioned that the Bible's destroyed. It comes out of the bottomless pit and flourishes, because it was Satan who had the Bible in a bottomless pit condition, and it's God who released it through John Wycliffe. And it's never destroyed. But it's God's direction that the beasts go into a bottomless pit and will be released and then destroyed because it's evil. And then it's God's will that Satan and his systems are restrained in a bottomless pit. And when they come forth, they will then be destroyed because they're evil. So, okay. Now, any comments on any of this? Ruth.
Seems to me like the principle of the bottomless pit, then. Tell me if I'm wrong. The only time something goes into the bottomless pit is when the Lord has a future use for it. So he puts it in a hiatus state where it's inactive and can't really function properly or according to its will until he decides to let it out again. And then the only reason he lets it out again is so then he can destroy it or so that it can be freed. But the only reason for anything to go into the bottomless pit is because the Lord has a future plan for it, to bring it out again.
That makes sense to me. Yeah. All right, good. Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Okay. So we'll leave the bottomless pit side study, if you will, there. And we'll look back to Revelation 17 and verse 8. And we discussed the beast that thou sawest and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into destruction. So I think we've covered that portion of the verse. It's the latter portion now we'd like to discuss, where it says, and they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, shall wonder whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. So who would like to help us understand these expressions? See, even half a verse is loaded with all this symbolic understanding. So let's try to unpack that. That's a good expression I hear on the news now all the time. It's a lot of information to try to unpack. So we could take it in pieces. We could ask ourselves, who are those that dwell on the earth? What's that represent for us? Ruth.
Well, when we just saw in Revelation 11, they were the ones that were rejoicing over the death of, not the death, but the humiliation of the scriptures. So they were the ones under that religious restraint where they were opposed to the scriptures. So here it seems like it would be a similar class. Those that are under religious restraint will marvel or wonder to see that the beast is coming back.
Okay, good. Thank you. I also saw at the same time, Brother Adi, your hand went up?
Yes, same comment.
Okay, Brother Chris?
Yeah, I was just thinking the earth is typically a stable society. So this is the whole world, in my opinion. They're all saying that Christianity has just bit the dust as the world understood it. And they're in total wonder. Their names they're not in any covenanted relationship. Their names aren't written in the book of life yet. So this is, they're just dumbfounded that at this whole scenario.
Okay.
Pretty broad interpretation. Over.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Ruth.
Well, on that same lines, it'll show that it was completely unexpected for the beast to come out again. Over. Everybody thought it was gone. Over.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So there is this wonder, astonishment by those under religious restraint when they see a church-state system come back into power for a brief time, and there's an astonishment when they see it destroyed after that brief hour. Either way you look at it, it is a marvel. It's a marvel it comes back as the eighth head, and it's a marvel it only lasted an hour. And then it's all exposed, and the errors of papacy is exposed, and it's destroyed. But those who marveled over this are those who probably received the mark of the beast and its image. So they aren't found worthy to be in the book of life, of the Lamb's book of life, to be part of the overcoming class. However, as pointed out, these will have an opportunity to gain life eternal in the peaceable kingdom when they come forth. But they certainly aren't worthy of life during this current lifetime because they received the mark. Any comments on any of that? Brother Mark.
Just one quick question. We're not saying that they will realize they weren't written in the Book of Life, are we? Because obviously they're not of the church class. They have no idea that that calling was even available during the Gospel Age, right?
Well, yeah, the only thing they're going to probably recognize in the end, is that they're probably going to come to the realization that they were sold a bill of goods by the churches, and they're not going to go to heaven. And that's what's going to make them mad. But they will have an opportunity in the future. Okay. Other comments? Well, then the next part that we go to is verses 9 through 11. And again, here another challenging portion. But let's read this and see, Sister Cheryl, could you read that for us, please? 9 through 11.
And here is the wisdom which hath wisdom. Oh, I'm sorry. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven and goeth into perdition or destruction. So we know these are the different forms of government. It's showing us periods of time. And you very well elaborated on, it being the fourth head that's going to come back. And one of my questions would be, I would have always just said, well, it's the papal system. So maybe it's for our benefit and not being a stumbling block to realize that the church-state union, that it's the state part that also is important so that we understand what's going on. Because I would have just always said it was just papacy. So it's taking us through time that we can see the period where we're at and what to expect. And as you brought out, it will be the fourth that will come back as the eighth. And we know what will happen. Over.
Okay, thank you. Yes, that you hit it well that in verse 9, here is the mind which hath wisdom. That is a very unusual expression, even for the Revelation. And that's where we're emphasizing it. It must take the new creature's mind, enlightened by the Holy Spirit, to be able to see through this mind-boggling deceptions that Satan wrought through his Antichrist systems, especially his chief one, the papacy. So in this chapter, the Lord seems to have shown us papacy as a harlot woman, the emphasis on the religious element that's always embraced by the people, whereas the beast, the church-state form of government, is only in existence at certain times, under certain heads. And it shows and emphasizes there's a civil power relationship with the papacy. So, yeah, that's very good. That is the point. So the seven, verse 9, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. There are seven kings. Five are fallen. One is, and the other's not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. So that's our verse that helps demonstrate that the heads are successive. You only have one head at a time. But here is the point that gets linked. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. That is really a challenge because the different suggestions brethren have made, you run into a problem one way or another way. It seems as if this is to be understood in an accommodated sense. And that's our suggestion. The accommodated sense is that the woman, the papacy as a religious system, has been in existence during the time of these seven forms of government. Mountains are a kingdom or a government. The woman's been in existence. She has been involved at some level. But is accommodated in the sense that the woman is shown sitting on the waters. In verse 1, and she's shown sitting in the waters, sitting on the waters, and she's not sitting on the beast when she's sitting on the waters. And we read that we saw her sitting on the waters during the sixth head, or the sixth form of government over the Roman Empire. The sixth form of government was Victor Emmanuel. So Victor Emmanuel was not a church and state government. So the woman wasn't supported by the beast. She wasn't sitting on the beast. She was sitting on the waters. She's always supported by the Roman Catholic people who believe in that religious system. But she apparently had some, she's in existence. And in some sense, she's acknowledged in an accommodated sense as having some influence, yeah, no matter how small it is. And it's, and I'll give the example like with Victor Emmanuel. He remained a Roman Catholic, even though he, through as a civil power, he took away the papal states from the papacy. He unified Italy by taking the papal states away from Italy. He reduced the papacy to the Vatican City area. So they hated him. They excommunicated him, but he never stopped being a Roman Catholic himself. So there was some influence there. But it was not a church-state form of government, so she's seated on the waters. Now there's another aspect, is that look in Revelation 12. In Revelation 12, when we studied through that chapter, you'll remember. Let's read a verse. Sister Roseanne, could you read for us Revelation 12, verses 3 through 5?
And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having seven heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon was ready to give, stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up in God and to his throne.
One more, please. Sorry.
Then the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days.
Okay. Very good. So, Sister Roseanne, you have thoughts on these verses to start?
I have a lot of thoughts. I just can't put it into words.
Sure. I can understand. Okay. Anyone like to start this for us? Brother Chris.
Well, these verses take us all the way back to Constantine. So we're back to the 300s, the very early, the first head. So we have the dragon here still in power, but this is the exchange, this is the big battle, and the Council of Nicaea, where his tail drew a third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. So Excuse me. So that's our time frame back to, 313 on Athanasius leading the charge of error, and 1/3 of the bishops in 313 fell for this, and so that's 325, et cetera, and these councils. So as you're bringing out, this takes us back to the first head. So she has influence. She's not controlling. She's not really riding the empire at this point, but she's influential. She's definitely gaining some steam. Over.
Okay, very good. That really hits the nail on the head. I appreciate that. That's why when I say there's an accommodated sense to understand the woman sitting on these seven mountains, we look back and we have to start with the dragon, who also is identified as having seven heads and ten horns. And that's the time when the Roman Empire was transferred to a nominal Christian empire under Constantine, like Brother Chris brought out. But it was the dragon. So we have to start counting these heads with this dragon period of Constantine. Okay. Sister Debbie.
I had a question on something a little different. Is that okay?
We could try.
What is the difference between waters and seas? I mean, because sometimes it says that she's on many waters, and then sometimes it's on a sea. So I'm wondering if there's a difference. Thank you.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. Well, we're told in Isaiah that the seas are like the restless mud, the wicked are like the restless sea. So we liken the sea class as being the opposite of the earth class. The earth is stable. It's religiously restrained society. Whereas the sea class is people not having religious restraint. So they're like the wicked that's stirred up all the time. But the waters on which the woman sits, it's not the sea. It's interpreted as being the peoples of a variety of countries and languages. So the waters are people. It's different from the earth, but it's an example that's it's also different than the sea. So kind of have to leave it sit there that, our interpretation is that when the woman sits on the waters, it's Roman Catholics who are supporting the religious belief or aspects of the papacy. Anyone else have something on that? Father Chris?
Just that, our symbol for water representing truth, but it also is the essence of life. It's life-giving. It's an essential part of, and so when she sits on the water, as opposed to the beast, this is what's giving her life. It's what's supporting her. She's giving her, without it, she'd dry up, and we see that later when the Euphrates dries up, the water goes away. So there's the life goes away. So just a simple connection with our other symbols. Over.
No, appreciate that. Very good. Very good. Well, let that sink in, but back to the verses in Revelation 12. This dragon has seven heads and ten horns. It's identified with the Roman Empire, and Constantine is, we're suggesting, Brother Chris said, repeating what he says, Constantine was the first of these seven heads that claimed to be Christian, nominally Christian. And the papacy, as this man-child, even though in its infancy, is on the scene, and there was the influences through Athanasius against Arius and the truth at that early time. But it gives us a good starting point on knowing where to count the heads. When do we start counting these seven forms of government? Because Rome as an empire had been long in existence prior to Christianity. So this helps us zero it in, we think. And that's the That's the peculiarity of our Revelation 17:9. Accommodated sense of the woman sitting on the seven mountains. Now, what was the more literal sense, which our reformer brethren previously used this verse as a means of identifying papacy? More of a literal sense. Ruth?
Well, they usually you think of the seven hills of Rome, literal, that Rome was established on. There were seven hills. And in fact, I have a note from the reprint, 472, that the medals and coins of the day represent Rome as a woman sitting on seven hills, and her titles were the Royal Rome, the Mistress of the World, the Queen of Nations. So it was more like a clue to somebody who was looking at it from a literal point of view.
Okay, very good. And in the notes, we list the names of those seven hills. We don't need to rattle them off here, but it's true. In her heyday, she was viewing this as a this was like a positive. She was powerful. She wasn't looking at it as like the harlot woman. She was looking at it, as Ruth said, as the mistress. And we remember that the church is depicted in the female form, more particularly in Scripture. So the papacy was an unfaithful woman. That's true, a harlot. But she thought of herself as a faithful woman. She thought of herself as the true church. That's okay. So there was this literal aspect. Okay, just going down. I wanted to make this one last point on the bottom of page 6. We note that when we were shown historically that during the fourth head, during the Holy Roman Empire, the church state system, that the woman rode the beast, papacy as a religion had greater control over the empire. But when that beast went into the bottomless pit in 1799, when Napoleon put the beast in the bottomless pit, that was the end of any form of church-state government, when the Pope died in prison, as it were, the woman didn't go into the bottomless pit. The woman, the harlot woman, is not said as going into the bottomless pit. Instead, that's when the woman, no longer riding a beast, because the beast, the church state system, is now no longer in existence, in a bottomless pit, reappear later, but the woman didn't go into the bottomless pit. Instead, she takes a seat on the waters. The people support her as a religion. The Roman Catholics support her as a religion. So the woman never goes into the bottomless pit. Okay. So that helps us understand this a little bit. And let me also say that under Napoleon, even though he put the Pope in prison, remember, he brought the Pope to his coronation when he wanted to be the emperor of the Roman Empire. But he just had the Pope watch as he put the crown on his own head. So she had a little influence there. Not in control by no means, but she was there during that fifth head period, for example, like we're saying. So then the seven heads list, page 9 at the top. We had you all remember that we studied the heads and the horns in great detail earlier, but here we're suggesting that Constantine and the Great and the Western Empire was the first head from 313 AD to 476. That the second head was the Goths and includes the various different tribes that that came into power 476 to 527 AD. Now, I thought it was very interesting that Sister Marilee just gave Ruth and I a magazine just last week when she was over. It's called Archaeology, and it has a number of articles in here, but it has one that I focus on, who were the Goths? And it's a number of pages, but I thought it was very succinct. When we studied this, as you know, we went through a lot of detail about the Goths at the time, but this article opens this way. During the latter centuries of the Roman Empire, writers described barbarian incursions from the east that slashed across their lands, including a fierce battle near the shores of the Black Sea in AD 251 that ended in the death of a Roman emperor and his son. Many of these attacks, they wrote, were perpetrated by a people they called the Goths, who, by the end of the 5th century AD, that's the 400s, at the end of the 400s, they would control much of what remained of the western half of the Roman Empire, their reach extending from the Black Sea to the Atlantic Ocean. In the space of just a few hundred years, they went from barbarian menace to kings of Europe. This is like a perfect quote for what we're trying to present here as the second head. You remember the Western Empire came into existence because our Constantine moved to the east, Constantinople, and built the great empire there, the eastern half of the Roman Empire. And he left the western half, and it fell to the Goths, as we just read. And later, we read in the third head, Justinian the First, 527 to 800 AD, of course, he was in the east part of the empire. But he elevated the Pope, the Bishop of Rome. And then the fourth head, Charlemagne, began the Papal Roman Empire, which then is symbolized by the counterfeit millennium, the counterfeit thousand years from 800 AD when the Pope first crowned an emperor, Charlemagne, and until the Pope died in prison under Napoleon, 1799. That is our fourth head. So-called Holy Roman Empire in large part. And then fifth head was Napoleon and his descendants, 1799 to 1870. Then Victor Emmanuel II and his descendants, 1870 to about 1925 AD. And I write this as accommodated as this is the date recognized for the rising up into power of Mussolini and the fascists over Italy. They weren't elected in, but through their aggression, they were then becoming much more influential. So we have the rise of the fascist and Nazi regimes as the seventh head, 1925 roughly to 1945, just a mere 20 years. And then it ceased to exist, as we know. So in the scripture, in verse 10, 17:10, there are seven kings, five are fallen, Constantine and the Western Empire, the Goths, Justinian the First, then Charlemagne and the Roman Empire, and then Napoleon, five are passed, one is Victor Emmanuel II during the time of Brother Russell. And the other's not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. That's the seventh. And the short space is just a mere 20 years. It's short compared to the other heads, which had lasted longer. And we all, you know, we recall that Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, they wanted to establish the Fourth Reich, They wanted to be the fourth reign over Europe. And that was their position. That's what they thought was their destiny. And of course that was ceased. And then it says, verse 17:11, and the beast that was and is not even, he is the eighth and is of the seven and goes into destruction. And so the eighth head is this repeat of church and state. Now we put in the notes under this eighth head, that we think that the timing is not brought to our attention anymore, particularly because we think it would give away a clue as to when the 144,000 would be complete, because we think that the feet members of Christ will have been sealed and that they will give a final witness, and the Lord doesn't want us to know when that is. We're to always be ready and waiting, but nonetheless we think that's partly why with this eighth head there's no more of a time frame given to us. The other thing we wanted to say is that there is a reprint article. It's short. I honestly didn't look at it recently, but Brother Russell does say, and it's an early article, he does say he thought that the eighth would be a headless beast, headless. And I have to say, I never understood that. I do know why it was expressed. It was as if there is a revolutionary government in power, it suggested that there's not a formal government like a head. So it suggested that this eighth is a headless revolutionary government. Well, it never appealed to me for several reasons. One is, first off, it says that this eighth is of the seven. Well, it's seven heads. So if you have an eighth, there's got to be another head. The other thing is, a headless beast, a beast without a head, is considered decapitated. It's considered to be dead. That's what you do. When David, as the shepherd boy, smote Goliath the Philistine with a stone, he went up and took Goliath's sword and cut off his head, held it up. So a headless beast is, to my mind, it's a dead beast. It didn't make sense to me that way. So I know Brother Russell made that comment. I don't know if he was following some of the other early brothers' writings on Revelation about that time, some of the early ones like Brother William Mann and others, which sometimes are good and sometimes we really don't think they are very good. Sometimes Brother Russell later disagrees with them, and sometimes they're good thoughts and he continues with them. But because Brother Russell said on several occasions that he had planned to write a seventh volume on Revelation, but he didn't. And he said in the final days, he said that someone else would have to write on the Revelation. In other words, he was saying that the Lord didn't allow him to write on the Revelation. So we take away from that is that when I read Brother Russell's comments on the Revelation, we take them for our instruction. And yet we also want to remember that he didn't write on a verse-by-verse interpretation consistently through the book, because he said he hadn't done that yet. So I think, you know, if you hold to that, that's fine. I just want to explain that for our own thinking, it doesn't seem to make scriptural sense. But are there any other comments on that? Brother David.
Sorry. I really like that comment about David and cutting off the head of Goliath with a sword, because the little flock, feet members, will have the sword of truth and be led by Christ. So we know all about the sword, that it's can cut and divide. So that will kill off the eighth dead.
All right. Thank you, Brother David. Thank you. Yeah, there's an interesting connection. The stone that smote Goliath in the head, it reminds us of the stone that smote the image, the metallic image on the feet, but then the sword of truth decapitates it. Very interesting.